The,
Call it a disservice, JJ, why don't you?
Well, we're going to have to leave it there.
We're going to have to leave it there.
J.J. Goldberg, editor-at-large of the Jewish Forward, the Jewish Daily Forward, his most recent article, As Gaza Toll Rises, Will Pressure, So Will Pressure on Israel. And Ali Abu Nima, the co-founder of the website, The Electronic Intifada, author of the new book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Has job openings. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KBOO reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KBOO's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio and Peña Flamenca de Portland are proud to co-sponsor Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. Pepe Rafael of Pepe and the Bottle Blondes will team up with Lily Last of Stomptown Flamenco for an evening of flamenco. Again, that's Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, located at Southeast 2nd Avenue and Madison Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
There's something happening that don't seem right. People on the sidewalk talking at night. You can't quite tell if they're talking about you, but you got a funny feeling that it might be true, and you can't make it go away. It's getting on you every day. It's only natural anyway, and you can't make it go away. You can cover your eyes, you can bury your head, duck inside and hide in your underwater bed. Turn up the radio as loud as it'll go. You can go to the go-go or duck inside a disco, but you can't make it go away. Gaining on you every day. It's only natural anyway, and you can't make it go away. You can vibrate and meditate, evacuate your brain. Tune into TV till your eyes go lame. You can grab onto God, you can lock him in your pocket. You can even stick your fingers in the light bulb socket. But you can't make it go away. It's getting on you every day. It's only natural anyway. And you can't make it go away. We'll be right back. of your hand. Look down upon us from where you stand. Invent statistics to insult and degrade. You can make us illegal, you can lock us in the stockade, but you can't make us go away. We're gaining on you every day. It's only natural anyway. You can't make it go away. You can call it a cat. You can do anything you want like that. You can hammer your head in the solid brick wall and still maintain that it isn't there at all. But you can't make it go away. It's gaining on you every day. It's only natural anyway. And you can't make it go away.
And this is KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. And that was Jim Page from Seattle. I really like that song, so I thought I'd let it go on for a while. And I think it's very appropriate to the times we're in. As you may have heard, since you're listening to this, you know we're back on the air since about 40 minutes ago. And so I hope... people who want to call in are now listening and ready to dial up and join in the conversation at 503-231-8187. I'm going to have a little bit of an introduction as usual. I'm going to follow up basically on the conversation that we started last week on this pamphlet, We Are All Very Anxious, Six Theses on Anxiety and Why It Is Effectively Preventing Militancy and One Possible Strategy for Overcoming It, by the Institute for Precarious Consciousness. I believe it comes out of Great Britain, I'm not sure. It's republished by Crime Think Workers Collective. Anyway, seemed to resonate with some people last week. But you know what I'm trying to do with this show, and again, I'm sort of trying this out. We haven't decided on a final permanent host for this slot, but I've been doing a fair amount of it. So what I've sort of been trying to do, you know, is to develop some kind of an ongoing conversation. I know, you know, everybody does that in their talk show because everybody has their own, you know, perspectives that obviously comes out in the way that we interact with our guests. But I'd like to have a little more thematic continuity, you know, and I talked in this... Sorry, that's my cell phone. That's embarrassing. I'll be right back. Live radio, what can you do? So, you know, in this pamphlet, we're talking about ways, and I've talked about the need for affinity groups as a strategy for, you know, coming together and confronting the situation that we're in because of, compartmentalization, alienation, separation that we all experience on a daily basis. And, you know, the affinity group kind of comes out of the anarchist tradition, you know, specifically out of the Spanish Civil War, where people with, the neighborhoods in some of the Spanish cities had a really strong social solidarity, and they came together in these affinity groups to fight the fascist takeover by Franco. And the affinity group has had real continuity through many social struggles of the latter part of the 20th century, the anti-nuclear movement, the gay rights movement, the women's movement, you know, the consciousness-raising groups were affinity groups. The Earth First, which I've had a lot of experience with, a lot of different movements have taken on the affinity group model as a way of basically getting to, you know, working with people that you know very well so that you can trust. Of course, we've also seen that has a downside, because if you end up working with people that are either infiltrators or end up maybe turning against you, then it can have a downside. So obviously people have to be extremely careful. But the other side I want to talk about is, you know, a couple days ago on this on KBOO, Lester Brown was on alternative radio with a talk called The Future of Civilization. The other side, meaning another approach to the affinity group kind of ground up model is the model of basically large coming from the top down, you know, coming from basically from existing institutional structures. And Lester Brown talked about, he called for something like a mobilization as happened in World War II to fight the global climate chaos. And he talked about the need for a mass mobilization to produce alternative energy. He talked about wind turbines. Now, the problem I have with that is such a mobilization presupposes that there has already been the huge social and political shift necessary to carry out such a mobilization. So basically, we're always back at square one, because in order to carry out such a mobilization, you have to already undergo the huge social and political changes necessary. So, you know, what I prefer to focus on, and the kind of programming that I would like to do on a more regular basis here, is to talk about the obstacles that we face directly in our daily lives. Because basically what we've got is not a technological problem. It's a social and cultural problem. And it's of a very deep-seated nature, such that we're often not aware of it. And so what they talk about in this pamphlet, We Are All Very Anxious, Six Theses on Anxiety, and they're not the only ones, obviously, who are talking about this, but they talk about these overarching modalities, dominant affect, he calls it. And affect means emotion, bodily disposition, way of relating. So these dominant modalities of ways of relating and ways of experiencing reality and of our emotional lives, basically that we're often unaware of. And they say in this pamphlet, each phase of capitalism has its own dominant reactive affect. And it talks about basically three phases of capitalism, roughly corresponding to the kind of the initial period of massive industrial expansion and the uprooting of masses of people from the countryside, a process, of course, that continues, and basically being enforced to work in the factory system, and the creation of this huge imbalance and the immiseration of large numbers of people. And so he characterized the dominant affect of that time as misery. And then with the whole period of the Great Depression, the huge crisis continuing, but the major crisis that happened in capitalism in the 1930s, and basically the imposition of a new regime, basically buying off labor and basically going to this a new way of relating between capital and labor, which resulted in the welfare state and basically incremental increases in wages, continually incremental increases in wages, and sort of a stable period that lasted two or three decades. And he characterized the dominant affect of that period as being boredom, and the movements of the 1960s being a reaction to that. And of course, this is a somewhat simplification. And they note in this that the dominant affect, it's not to say that this is the only reactive affect in operation. The new dominant affect can relate dynamically with other affects. For example, a call center worker is bored and miserably paid, but anxiety is what keeps her, him in this condition, preventing the use of old strategies such as unionization, sabotage, and dropping out. And I read a lot from talking about the first two phases last time. If you didn't listen to that, well, you can still basically get the basic scenario I'm putting out. And you can also find this online if you just Google We Are All Very Anxious. And I will have the links to that on the archive audio that I will put up after this show. So as you got from what I just said, the third period phase of capitalism, or the affect of capitalism, is called, he says, is characterized by anxiety. So I would just like to read what I hadn't read last time, which is talking about that specifically. In contemporary capitalism, the dominant reactive affect is anxiety. Today's public secret is that everyone is anxious. Anxiety has spread from its prevalent localized locations, such as sexuality, to the whole of the social field. All forms of intensity, self-expression, emotional connection, immediacy, and enjoyment are now laced with anxiety. It has become the linchpin of subordination. One major part of the social underpinning of anxiety is the multifaceted, omnipresent web of surveillance. The NSA, closed-circuit TV, performance management reviews, the job center, the privileges system in the prisons, the constant examination and classification of the youngest school children. But this obvious web is only the outer carapace. We need to think about the ways in which a neoliberal idea of success indicates these surveillance mechanisms inside the subjectivities and life stories of most of the population. We need to think about how people's deliberate and ostensibly voluntary self-exposure through social media, visible consumption, and choice of positions within the field of opinions also assumes a performance in the field of the perpetual gaze of virtual others. We need to think about the ways in which this gaze inflects how we find, measure, and know one another as co-actors in an infinitely watched perpetual performance. Our success in this performance in turn affects everything from our ability to access human warmth to our ability to access means of subsistence, not just in the form of the wage, but also in the form of credit. Outsides to the field of mediated surveillance are increasingly closed off as public space is bureaucratized and privatized, and a widening range of human activity is criminalized on the grounds of risk, security, nuisance, quality of life, or antisocial behavior. In this increasingly securitized and visible field, we are commanded to communicate. The incommunicable is excluded. Since everyone is disposable, the system holds the threat of forcibly delinking anyone at any time in a context where alternatives are foreclosed in advance, so that forcible delinking entails desocialization, leading to an absurd non-choice between desocialized inclusion and desocialized exclusion. I know this is a little difficult. You kind of have to reread this to really get what they're saying here, but this threat is manifested in small ways in today's disciplinary practices, from timeouts and internet bans to firings and benefit sanctions, culminating in the draconian forms of solitary confinement found in prisons. Such regimes are the zero degree of control by anxiety, the breakdown of all the coordinates of connectedness in a setting of constant danger, in order to produce a collapse of personality. The present dominant affect of anxiety is also known as precarity. Precarity is a type of insecurity which treats people as disposable so as to impose control. Precarity differs from misery in that the necessities of life are not simply absent. They are available, but withheld conditionally. Precarity leads to generalized hopelessness, a constant bodily excitation without release. Growing proportions of young people are living at home. Substantial portions of the population, over 10% in the UK, are taking antidepressants. The birth rate is declining as insecurity makes people reluctant to start families. In Japan, millions of young people never leave their homes, what are known as the hikikomori, while others literally work themselves to death on an epidemic scale. Surveys reveal half the population of the UK are experiencing income insecurity. Economically, aspects of that of the system of anxiety include lean production, financialization and resultant debt slavery, rapid communication and financial outflows, and the globalization of production. Workplaces like call centers are increasingly common, where everyone watches themselves, tries to maintain the required service orientation, and is constantly subject to retesting and potential failure, both by quantitative requirements on numbers of calls and a process which denies most workers a stable job. They have to work 6 months to even receive a job, as opposed to a learning place. Image management means that the gap between the official rules and what really happens is greater than ever. And the post-9/11 climate channels this widespread anxiety into global politics. And I might continue reading that a little bit later. But again, I want to, you know, this can just become just another sort of laying on of information that people are passively receiving, which is partly what I was criticizing the Lester Brown talk on the future of civilization, or that style of doing things. And much as I admire Lester Brown and all the good work that the World Watches Institute has done over the years and the great information they put out, But the problem is not information. Information is available. The problem is that we get frustrated by having so much information and not having good outlets to do things. So what I advocate and what they advocate in this pamphlet is forming these small affinity groups, which can be study groups, which can definitely need to lead to action as well, because the paralysis of analysis, as we know, is very real. So anyway, I would recommend highly. I did make this available. I'll make it available again at the front desk for anyone who wants to come pick it up. It is available online. It's called, again, We Are All Very Anxious, Six Theses on Anxiety and Why It is Effectively Preventing Militancy and One Possible Strategy for Overcoming It. And of course, we could also talk about what they mean by militancy. Sometimes people get turned off by that word. They think of military. They think about stridency. What I think of when I think of militancy is people becoming actors in our own lives and directly confronting these structures of power and authority, which are creating this situation that we are all trapped in. You know, and whatever it might be, I would recommend people go to the website CopBlock, B-L-O-C-K, where they not only have continually, like daily, videos of abusive and overly aggressive and sometimes violent and even lethal behavior by our law enforcement officers. But they also have people standing up and people basically who know their rights and who express those rights very directly to police officers. And so there's a lot to learn. And so basically the act of standing up directly and just on a personal level, on a day-to-day level, and also on a more collective level, which is what we really need to get to and where the real problem lies, in my opinion, is very instructive. And so I would recommend that website, CopBlock, B-L-O-C-K. And we already have a couple callers, so before I continue with my own monologue, let's hear what other people have to say. James, you're on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Right on.
I'm in recovery, and I have, you know, I've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and all that kind of stuff. I can't even work. My emotional problems are so severe. So I've been dealing with this, you know, for over 20 years now, and the best thing that I have found for anxiety is being a service. I mean, that's what it all boils down to. It's a spiritual principle. Be of service. And we're going to have to, as a society, start focusing on each other and how we can help each other, and because we are being squeezed. I believe that we are being squeezed by the same dang imperialists that squeezed India. In fact, I was watching Gandhi last night, and it's a great movie. And we need a movement like Gandhi had. I mean, that's all there is to it, because they are so powerful. They will. It's a machine, and they will grind us up and spit us up and chew us up and spit us out.
It's certainly already, that's what it's already doing. And I admire, you know, obviously there's lots of historical parallels that we could draw. And I would say yes and no, because, you know, history only happens once the way it happens. And so there's lessons to be learned from all social movements, but obviously I'm sure you would recognize this as well. It's not going to happen exactly like it happened in India. The conditions are very different.
This is America, so it's going to look differently. We're all going to have to find our own perception of our higher power, and we're going to have to tap into that, and we're going to have to start loving and caring for one another. And that's what it all boils down to. And we got to get control of the food supply. If we don't get control of the food supply, we are in serious trouble.
I agree with you there. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Again, the number is 503-231-8187. Thanks, James, for calling in. The So I just want to get back to, again, this kind of the counterposition between, you know, these two approaches. I mean, it's very obviously everything when you try to do these things, you're obviously going to oversimplify, becomes kind of schematic. Obviously, you know, we have to go upon what we experience. We have to start from where we're at in our daily lives and, you know, take lessons from what I'm saying, from what other people are saying and doing. But we need to find different modalities. Basically, obviously, it's becoming all too clear that whatever it is this social form that we have been living in, that we have developed, is dysfunctional. So we need to understand something about what that social form, and that's what I like about this thing. It talks about public secrets, that these dominant affects, just as Marx, you know, revealed the hidden structure of, you know, the capitalist system, the social relations and the modes of production to people who had basically undergone this really rapid industrialization and were just caught in this, you know, undertow, basically, and couldn't really understand because everything was happening so fast. I think Marx gave these really powerful tools, analytical tools for understanding it. I think this pamphlet does something similar, just as, you know, the whole psychoanalytic movement also gave tools for understanding psychological processes, and all these things inform us. And so in the spirit of that, I think this is a very valuable addition to contemporary discourse, this pamphlet that I'm reading from. But again, everybody's got their own, and, you know, we're all trying to understand together. But the basic point, I think, is what I'm saying is that we need to somehow come to some common understandings, that what has happened through this in this process, you know, some people call it, you know, focus on capitalism. I prefer to talk about a much longer process. Some people call that civilization itself. I know that's very controversial, but these dominant, overarching, centralized power structures, that modality has only been around for several thousand years. And, you know, it is basically characterized by, you know, coercion, exploitation, alienation, compartmentalization, and basically a delegation of authority to other peoples. Whereas, you know, I think we lost something fundamental when we lost the basic smaller kinship unit. And again, these are all things that need to be discussed, but, you know, the strong social bonds that inhere in that kind of form of social organization is basically what we've lost. And that's something very fundamental. So that's why I point to, and other people point to, affinity groups of some form, since, you know, most of us no longer live in, you know, extended families, in small communities, in strong neighborhoods. All these things have been disintegrated and continually be disintegrated by this basic social process that we're talking about. So, you know, we can call for all these grand solutions of appropriate, you know, technology, of green technology, of some sort of large mobilization, as Lester Brown talks about. But unless we deal with these more fundamental obstacles, personal psychological and collective social obstacles, we're continuing to remain trapped in the same basic dynamic. Looks like we do have a couple callers. Mimi, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for your show and good morning. I couldn't agree with you more with what you just said. The way that I talk about that as far as our social reality is that a long time ago, when we all collectively, when we were a small bunch of humans roaming the earth, when we left the fire, we started to have our own families. I think that's when everything started to decline, because we forgot at that point that the whole is what matters. And we started to think that it was just our little families. And then, of course, that exponentially grew into where we are now. And so we don't have a piece of understanding, a level of understanding about the whole anymore. You know what I mean? But the other part of it for me is, regarding the caller before me, the food issue. My issues are radiation in the world, and I run a thing called Radcast. And what I find is that our food is affected now by radiation. And no matter what we do, we can't change that. It's just going to get worse because we have more nuclear plants that are going to explode and melt down, and that's just going to happen as drought continues. So we're kind of in a predicament with that, with the food supply. So it's not about owning our food anymore. It's about what are we going to do, what are we going to eat, when we have nothing left to eat that is not going to kill us. And that's kind of the road that we're on right now, and we're working on a project right now to determine exactly how much radiation is in our food, because the governments aren't telling us. And I say plural governments because it's happening in Japan, and they won't let the information out from Japan in the rice paddies and everything else that's going on, and here as well. So we have a lot of big issues that we can't turn around, no matter what affinity groups we're a part of. At this point, for me, it's not about losing hope, and it's not about hope at all. I don't really concern myself with hope. I concern myself with reality. And it seems to me like our reality is quite different from how it was 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And I'll leave you with all of that.
Well, I'm not sure exactly where you're going with that in terms of, you know, how we confront the situation that we're in.
Well, the only thing I think we can do at this point is learn about the situation that we are in. How do you confront radioactive food? You can't confront that other than to say that the nuclear power that we do have currently running around the world needs to be shut down immediately so that we can deal with the fuel rods, begin to cool them down. We already know that we don't have a place to store them safely anywhere.
Right, but you say that they need to be shut down, but again, that presupposes that we have the capability of doing it. So we're back to square one again. So,
well, I kind of agree with you. Nuclear power has no answers at this point. It only has terrible outcomes.
Right. Okay. Well, so that's the general situation that I'm trying to outline. You know, whatever we're basically in a generalized, you know, I think increasingly we realize we're in a totally generalized crisis, as, you know, perhaps it's end game, as Derek Jensen and other people call it, that basically the fruits of the entire, you know, the entire weight, cumulative effect of all these actions that and the basically the accumulation of technological infrastructures and toxic processes and everything else is such that we're basically, you know, we're unraveling the basic fabric of, you know, the biosphere itself, right? So
that's exactly right.
Right. So the situation remains that we're still living beings. We're here on the planet, and we have to live our lives. So the basic challenge is, how do we actually live our lives? And so what I'm putting out is the fact that, you know, if indeed, you know, the only way to really, that was demonstrated to live effectively on the planet is in these smaller, close-knit groups, which I personally believe, then we have to approximate that again in order to just, whatever it is, in order to just live satisfying, whether it's to live satisfying lives, whether it's to gain some kind of power to resist whatever is happening, whether it's perhaps even the dream of forming a bunch of affinity groups and coming together in larger mobilized groups to actually challenge the powers once again. Whatever level it is, it seems like that's the challenge that we're facing, is to reform in closer knit groups that really get to really know each other and understand each other and can work well together. And so whatever we're trying to deal with, that's basically the model that I'm proposing.
I think it's a good model. I also think, though, that we at this point can't end the regimes that exist in order to keep us down. I'm not saying don't try. I would never say that, because I believe in trying. But I also believe, like I said, in the reality. And their reality, which is, again, what the other caller was saying before me, is that they are so big at this point. You know, they are responsible for the lack of food supply. They are responsible for radiation in the food supply. They are responsible for human death everywhere and death of all sustainability on the planet. You know, how do we combat that? That's kind of, that is our reality now. So yes, to what you're saying, I think that, you know, having a smaller group of people who you can depend on for whatever that is, whatever our new paradigm is becoming, I think that that is a positive step just to get through it in whatever that means.
Well, thank you for calling, Mimi. We have a couple more callers, and we'll continue to explore that. Who's our next caller? Phil, you're on the air.
Hello, Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Phil. I called in last week.
Okay.
I recommended that people read underminers.org and Sandra Elder's Scapegoat Theory. And the reason why I'm saying this again is because just listening to the callers calling in, it shows that the depth of understanding, what I believe you're trying desperately to get across here, and in the material, I read the material on Crime Think, and I disagreed slightly, but basically I understand their point. But I just would like to say, this is so hard. I'm 63 years old. I'm a radical anarchist. I was arrested and attacked at all the Occupy Portland marches, everyone, wear full dress, anarchist gear, masks and everything. So I saw this really kind of depressing situation unfold. And I've spent all this time really thinking about what took place and why there wasn't that ignition. Social ignition, and that, I think, is the crux of what you're saying.
Right, because this underlying, fabric doesn't exist. It's been unraveled. We have to reweave that fabric, and it may well be impossible. I certainly don't have any grand illusions. I have no more illusions about that than I do about this, you know, the grand mobilization theory of social change that people like Lester Brown, much as I respect him, put out. But I come from a very different position. But I think it's the only one that has a chance of actually gaining some sort of traction in our lives here and now.
Well, yeah, back in the, I think it was in the late 70s or 80s, there was this, the 100th monkey theory. It was this metaphysical crap that said there was a bunch of monkeys on an island, and they learned to do a thing, and all of them learned to do it. And then spontaneously, monkeys on another island started learning to do this thing. Just metaphysically, knowledge transferred from one group to another. And right today, we're dealing with that on a grand scale. Our minds are desperately trying to find answers that feel good. The fact is, as a radical, violent radical person, that's my background, I've been attacked since the 1960s by the police. And I can tell you that the real, standing next to the, you know, to the brothers down in L.A., Black Panthers, and looking at the courage of the Iranian students as they were being attacked openly, you realize that the depth of knowledge has to be there. The people do have to sit down and read, understand Marxism, get into the anarchist stuff, but the anarchist stuff's a little depressing as well, too, and I'm an anarchist. I'm really glad that they think as much as they do, but in the material that you cited from last week, which I read, it leaves you still kind of right back here today, which, by the way, I really, really, really love this show. I really love what you're doing, and the fact that you continued it on this week, I don't want to forget to just thank you so much, because we're missing the connectedness from one conversation to another, and people get off on tangents. So I just wanted to say that, you know, I think what you're saying and what you're doing is very constructive.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that. I just want to go off a little bit on that 100th monkey idea. I kind of have this idea of the idea of the invisible hand of the movement, that somehow if each of us in our own little spheres continues to soldier on and do what we're doing, somehow it's all going to magically come together and have some sort of grand resolution, which is sort of, you know, what I criticize of sort of the an aspect of Marxism which sort of became predominant, sort of the historical determinism that somehow inevitably, you know, this there's going to be this transformation from within the internal contradictions, et cetera, which, you know, denies the you know, to some extent, and obviously this is a long discussion, but I focus on, you know, our agency here and now, but mostly I focus on our collective agency because, you know, what Marx depended upon was this kind of class consciousness which grew out of a different epoch, that really the factory system where people did have class consciousness because they were all working together and they all lived in the same neighborhoods. But that's exactly what has been basically deconstructed, partly consciously, maybe largely unconsciously. And that's the new situation which we're in, which was a situation of precarity and anxiety, which is why I really like this publication. Anyway, well, thank you very much for calling. We do have a couple more callers. We have Sunny. Hello.
Hello, hello. I'm glad that you've returned to this subject again because I thought it was really so interesting and valuable when you brought it up from the very beginning. And, you know, as to class consciousness and all of that sort of thing, which I'm not a Marxist or anything. I'm just a human being and I'm not familiar much with Marx's writing. But that idea of class consciousness is understandable to me, and I know at this time people are very distracted. They're working, they're distracted by their many concerns for survival, and then of course we have entertainment, and the fragmentization of it, which occurred to where a person can watch their own particular show, or they can communicate with their own little teeny tiny click on the internet, and then anyway, what I'm saying is I think that we're being entertained out of class consciousness.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that was both, again, a conscious and an unconscious strategy of the system to basically to create more opportunities for profit, because if you consume entertainment and don't produce it yourself, you know, like people for the entire history of human existence were able to entertain ourselves without having to pay for it and having, you know, mediated by large institutional structures and corporations and all that. So obviously it's both an outlet for, an avenue of profit. And as you say, it's a way to distract people, to keep people from focusing on what's really going on.
To immobilize and sedate people. And then the other thing that I think is happening and which is important is, it comes down, I think, to two principles, care or not care. And care is connected to the heart. And as long as people are connected to their heart as well as their mind, which is, of course, very important also, then they have a lot to work with. And this society and this culture would seem to suggest to us that it doesn't matter, that it's not an important functioning part of the being. But the truth is, what the world we're living in, especially now, the heart is more important than ever. And people that will look to their heart and join with others in looking to their heart, then they are a heart nation. And there are many, many different nations of people on the planet walking around in their own different ways as individuals and groups. And with the heart, there is a lot to do. A lot is possible, and we are living in this new radiated world. The old world is over. We are already in a new world, and the only way we're going to get through a little ways, even at all, to whatever is going to come next, is we've got to get with the heart. And the problem is that we're actually afraid even to get to our hearts on individualized levels of, you know, neighborliness or, you know, involvement. But the fact of the matter is that the heart is still there within most of us, not all of us, and it's a tremendous resource. It is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for your conversation today.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, I, you know, obviously in hearts and minds together have to connect with other hearts and minds.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to obviously, and you know, the problem is we're, you know, we're trapped. I mean, I always say we. I don't like to separate it. I don't like to say they, because I'm certainly feeling, you know, disconnected and all these things. Perhaps sometimes I think doing this radio show is sort of a way of, you know, a substitute almost. I think one way I look at this whole development of this mass insanity that we live in is basically as a vast substitution complex for, you know, basically our more basic needs of heart, mind, soul, and body, and the substitution by other, basically other ways of not really satisfying them. So we're always kind of unsatisfied, going back to, you know, wherever you want to start with. So anyway, we have a couple more callers.
That's really good what you said, and I think what you're talking about is vital.
Okay.
Very vital. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We have Joanne on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Joanne.
Yeah, hello. Yes, I'll tell you why, Paul, I can't join your movement or anybody else's, and please give me a chance to do so. Some years ago, when I was feeling down and sad and anxious and angry, I got into the hands of many different kinds of mental health people, and I allowed myself to be labeled and medicated. And some years later, I needed an income, and I applied for Social Security disability. And because of the way the system is, and probably still is, I had to take it on being mentally ill instead of all my physical stuff. And I also realize now that the mental health field has not risen to a higher place about life and people. Anyway, I get off the air, and thank you for listening.
Okay. I'm not sure sure what you want us to do with that. I mean, obviously, I feel empathy for the fact that you're stuck in a bad situation, and you know, some people are stuck in situations that they can't get out of, and that's a terrible, that one of the terrible, many terrible tragedies of the times that we're in, because you know, we just don't have the surplus, you know, we don't have it at the level of institutions, or the institutions would be dealing with this in the kind of way that they're not. As Joanne points out, the mental health system, I mean, if you listen to Madness Radio, other programs on KBOO, and read stuff out there, there's plenty of information about how these systems are not just broken, but have been dysfunctional from the very beginning, because they're not really able to, because they don't address the fundamental underlying problem, which is the basic disintegration of good social relationships. But we do have three callers online, and only 13 minutes left. Go ahead, Harry, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. And you were talking about anxiety, and how the anxiety is delivered to us is through the news media and their propaganda. So,
well, that's one avenue, yeah.
Yes. So how do we control this? Do we limit ourselves on listening to the news, maybe listen to the news once a day, or boycott all cable news outlets, or something like that?
Well, I think what this pamphlet was talking about, what I'm talking about, is we need to find outlets for dealing with our anxiety. And anxiety comes partly from frustration, because so if you get... you get information in, and you're not able to assimilate it in an effective way, and then use it to deal with the whatever you're learning from that information, then all it does is create frustration, more frustration. So no, I think the thing is, we have to, as I try to put out, we have to find like-minded people who we can communicate, because sometimes it's just even hard to find one person, a confidant, to actually have a good conversation with, have people that you feel like that understand you, that you resonate with, and that you can move forward on common projects with. And so that's why I advocate the overwhelming urgency of finding groups of like-minded people to have regular conversations with, and not just listen to the news, but maybe listen to the news or read things together, share together, so that you resonate more and more with each other, and you can come to decide on courses of action together, whatever that might be. That's what I recommend.
Well, I have one more comment about the woman who called in about the radiation.
Mm-hmm.
I have a solution to our radiation problem. We can take all those casts, like at Trojan and stuff, and launch them into deep space. We can launch all our radiation into deep space.
Okay. Well, that's the kind of technological solution that I think might possibly be there. But I think, I guess that those, you know, these are all to be discussed. But where do we discuss these things? I mean, and who, you know, how do we come to that decision? Like, if that's a solution, then who decides and how does that decision come to? I'm calling into question the very modalities of making decisions that have dominated for many years, decades, and centuries, that these large centralized systems of control that have proven incapable of getting themselves out of the crises that they continually create. They only create more crises from the solutions that they continue to propose. I'm proposing something very, very different.
Oh, and about 20 years ago, Hillary Clinton wrote a book, It Takes a Village. And what I remember about that book, try to get everyone together to raise the country, raise your kids and everything else, but there's also people out there who don't believe in that and who's fighting against that. I assume that's what's going on. Do you remember the book?
I heard about it, yeah.
Okay. That's all I have for you. Thank you very much for this topic.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in. And we do have another caller. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Well, you know, I feel it's all about quantanglement, quantum entanglement, the new physics of, turns out that quantum is a study of the smallest particles, and it turns out that at the smallest levels that there is this interesting phenomenon called entanglement, where two electrons or two photons, when they're entangled, no matter how far you separate them, they're connected. Like across the universe, you affect one, the other's affected. You flip the polarity of one, the other goes the other way. And so I feel that since our scientists tell us that the universe sprang forth from a primordial atom, from one atom that was incredibly densely packed, that we're all entangled. We're all at the quantum level, we're all entangled. And this is a consciousness that I go around with. I don't feel separated from everybody. I feel, there's connection, there's inclusion. And I think that we have to teach this new physics to everybody, because we all know about Newtonian physics, which is the law of separation, which is the law of the physics of the large things, you know.
But your feeling of connection has to be reciprocated, so you have to actually be in a relationship with
yes.
people. I mean, okay, you can say that you're in a relationship with someone on the other side of the planet or the universe or something, but I think we're, you know, warm-blooded creatures that crave and need direct validation and affection and nurturing. And so I think we tend to need these close-knit, physical proximity and affinity. And so I think that's what I'm sort of pointing at.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I also feel that, you know, one of the largest websites or some of the largest websites up there are all about entanglement, like Facebook and websites that bring us together on common factors. So that's what people seek. They do seek kind of inclusion with each other, and I feel.
But I don't think you are agreeing with me, because I'm actually saying something very different from what you just said.
Uh huh. Well, I just feel that this is the new way we should. This is the new education. It has to start with a way of thinking, and if we can get past all this, you know, there's so many forces out there that try to separate us and put us in boxes and give us labels, and so we have to forge past that with the new physics. And see it as a reality, not just as a concept. And then we won't see necessarily, you know, because our big problem on the planet today is we all see the other as the other. They're not us. And the other is one we want to get rid of. So I think that we need quantanglement, a new language of inclusion, a new language of respect, instead of calling each other colors, you know. Like, it's interesting how, you know, the King of England is called His Royal Majesty Prince Somebody, and you and I, we call each other white and black. I mean, let's raise it up here. Let's start calling each other by names that give each other, royalty, or give make us proud and make us strong, make us, instead of just calling each other, just speaking the language of war, the language of separation, which the media leads us into. So I'm just calling for a new thinking, and quantanglement is the thinking I'm looking for.
Okay. Well, thank you for that contribution.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. And I'm just going to read a little bit more from this pamphlet again. We are all very anxious. 6 Theses on Anxiety. Part 5, Anxiety is a Public Secret. Excessive anxiety and stress are a public secret. When discussed at all, they are understood as individual psychological problems, often blamed on faulty thought patterns or poor adaptation. Indeed, the dominant public narrative suggests that we need more stress so as to keep us, quote, safe through securitization and, quote, competitive through performance management. Each moral panic, each new crackdown or new round of repressive laws adds to the cumulative weight of anxiety and stress arising from general overregulation. Real human insecurity is channeled into fueling securitization. This is a vicious circle because securitization increases the very conditions, in parentheses, disposability, surveillance, intensive regulation, which cause the initial anxiety. In effect, the security of the homeland is used as a vicarious substitute for security of the self. Again, this has precedence. The use of national greatness as vicarious compensation for misery, and the use of global war as a channel for frustrations arising from boredom. Anxiety is also channeled downwards. People's lack of control over their lives leads to an obsessive struggle to reclaim control by micromanaging whatever one can control. Parental management techniques, for example, are advertised as ways to reduce parents' anxiety by providing a definite script they can follow. On a wider social level, latent anxieties arising from precarity fuel obsessive projects of social regulation and social control. This latent anxiety is increasingly projected onto minorities, people of different colors, of different genders, of different sexualities, whatever. We see that continually. Anxiety is personalized in a number of ways, from new right discourses blaming the poor for poverty to contemporary therapies which treat anxiety as a neurological imbalance or a dysfunctional thinking style. 100 varieties of management discourse, time management, anger management, parental management, self-branding, gamification, offer anxious subjects an illusion of control in return for ever greater conformity to the capitalist model of subjectivity. And I would just say that, you know, everything's kind of double-edged sword. Like, for example, this yoga, great boom in yoga, is both. It's both a very good, because I do yoga myself, way of dealing with stress and anxiety and getting more in tune and resonance with ourselves. But it also can become another form of personal management and basically not dealing with these wider issues. This continues at length. I could go on. But again, I just wanted to let you know that this is going to be available here at the front desk at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th. And on the archive audio from this, which you can find at kboo.fm, I will have links, the same links I had for last week's show and maybe some others, and how to get a hold of this publication. So maybe we can, you know, this is just, again, everybody has their own thing that they think everybody should read. When I first read this, like, oh, everybody, we need to all read this and discuss this. But, you know, you don't have to focus on this. There's many other things. But this is, an interesting starting point. And so I'm trying to, you know, make that one point of conversation. But we need to have more conversations together and more togetherness. And I hope to continue this conversation with you all. My name's Paul Rowland, and this has been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Thanks, Steve, for engineering.
You can cover your eyes, you can bury your head, duck inside and hide in your underwater bed. Turn up the radio as loud as it'll go. You can go to the go-go or duck inside a disco, but you can't make it go away. Gaining on you every day.
natural anyway, and you can't make it go away. You can vibrate and meditate, evacuate your brain, tune into TV till your eyes go lame. You can grab on the God, you can lock him in your pocket, you can even stick your fingers in the light bulb socket, but you can't make it go away. It's gaining on you every day, it's only natural anyway, and you can't make it go away.
And good morning, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. We've got quite a lineup for you this morning. Coming right up, it's Per Fagering hosting a call-in discussion about the bombing of Gaza and the killings of Palestinian civilians. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off today. We're going to go straight to Flashpoints, which features a report on the latest Israeli attack on a school and on a hospital surgery ward that killed two nurses and two patients. Also, host Dennis Bernstein speaks with Professor Richard Falk, former UN Rapporteur for Human Rights in Israel and the Palestinian Territories. And activist Pedro Reyes talks about the kids coming over the border from Central America. At 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Sandy Polishuk, divestment coordinator with 350PDX and also with solar design consultant Jesse Hunter, about the necessity and strategies for shifting from fossil fuels to renewables. And once again, thank you so much, KBOO members, for your great support. If you are not a member, it's easy to become one. You can just go to kboo.fm and click where it says donate today. Please do that, and thanks for that. We're going to go, let's play a couple of announcements, and then we'll go straight to Pear with his call.